Thank you very much. Dear Kirk, first of all, I would like to say thank you very much for your friendly introduction and for the invitation to the Minnesota State University. It's a great honor and a great pleasure for me to give you a report on our research on biosciences and biopolicy in National Socialist Germany. And I will concentrate on the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology, Human Heredity, and Eugenics. You can see the building built up in 1927 at the picture. It wasn't destroyed in World War II, and today it's part of the Free University of Berlin. Below, at the left, you can see Eugen Fischer. He was director of the Institute from 1927 to 1942. And it's a very interesting picture because he is studying photographs of the so-called Rehoboth Bastards, a mixed population in German Southwest Africa, Fischer investigated in 1913. At the right, we see his successor, Ottmar von Verschuer. He was the director of the Institute from 1942 to 1945. And on this picture, he's doing twin research. The Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology was famous for twin research. This picture was published in the New York Times Magazine in a large article about the Institute. And they stressed this was the largest and the most advanced institute on twin research at that time. On May 24th, 1939, in front of the general meeting of the Kaiser Wilhelm Society in Breslau, Baron Ottmar von Verschuer, the director of the Institute for Hereditary Biology and Racial Hygiene at the University of Frankfurt, delivered a speech on the genetic map of the human being. Verschuer's appearance was well calculated, since for quite some time he had already been traded as the successor of his mentor and friend Eugen Fischer, who was then about to retire from his function as the director of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology, Human Heredity and Eugenics in Berlin-Dahlem. Verschuer's lecture meant to highlight the successes of human genetics. According to his account, roughly 1,000 of the approximately 30 to 60,000 human genes had lately been identified, as well as several hundreds of hereditary diseases whose mechanisms of being passed on had, for the most part, been detected too. Quote, "Man is a manifoldly scrutinized object of human sciences." Finally, Verschuer talked about the practical realization of human hereditary theory, and in this regard, he also ventilated optimism. His lecture culminated in an emphatic confession of faith towards National Socialist politics of race and eugenics. Quote, "The convergence between political and scientific thoughts is not a coincidence, but an innate necessity. We hereditary biologists and racial hygienists remain in the seclusion of our scientific research activities, since we are firmly convinced that in this field, too, battles are fought, which are of paramount importance for the survival of our people." End of quote. Indeed, wide areas of National Socialist politics of race and eugenics, in fact, to the point of unconcealed extermination, were legitimized, planned, prepared, carried out, and assessed with regard to their efficiency by drawing on scientific expertise. Ultimately, National Socialism followed the idea of all-embracing and omnipresent biopolicy and strived for complete control over birth and death. Sexuality and reproduction, body and germline, variability and evolution. on the basis of rational planning and management. For this purpose, a whole host of different sciences, such as genetics, biology, anthropology, medicine, psychiatry, psychology, criminal biology, neurology, brain research, demography, social hygiene, and eugenics were made extensive use of. As Fischer's statement illustrates, the biosciences, on the other hand, readily volunteered for serving and supporting Nazi biopolicy since 1933. Regardless of the Nazification of the universities and other research agencies, as well as of the discharge and expulsion of Jewish or politically unwelcomed scientists. Three agencies of the Kaiser Wilhelm Society, the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology in Berlin-Dahlem, the German Research Institute for Psychiatry in Munich, and the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Brain Research in Berlin-Buch, formed central knots within the close-meshed network between biosciences and politics. These three institutes provided a solid legitimatory basis for the eugenical legislation of the Nazi rulers. They defended the compulsory sterilizations carried out on a massive scale on international conferences. And they tried to enlist the support of the German public by disseminating popular scientific treatises and giving lectures in the same vein. As members of expert panels, the scientists of these three institutes actively and directly contributed to the continuous development of hereditary and race politics. Due to their experts' reports, they had a key role in the process of recording and selecting the so-called genetically impaired persons, the so-called Rhineland bastards, the Jews or gypsies. Furthermore, they were also actively involved in the training and education of expert personnel for the execution of hereditary and race politics. According to their self-understanding as applied sciences, the biosciences were keen on translating their results into possible instructions for political action. Towards the end of the 1930s, however, this procedure became increasingly problematic, since genetics, which at that time was the crucial science of reference for all biosciences, was involved in a fundamental and far-reaching process of change. In our context, the expansion of human hereditary theory towards a developmental kind of genetics was most decisive. The commonly held idea that every human characteristic was individually handed down either dominantly or recessively, according to the rules of Mendel, could not endure against the results of developmental physiology, mutation research, and population genetics, and thus was substituted by a so-called higher Mendelism, which was based on rather more complicated ideas of hereditary mechanisms. It was realized that genes could not be scrutinized individually, but had to be investigated in the context of their genotypical milieu, since the effect of a gene was always influenced by other genes, if not by the whole of the human genome. This complexity was further increased by the prenatal influences on the embryo's maturation, as well as by environmental influences, which shaped the manifestation of genes. Thus, the complex interdependences between the hereditary and environmental factors and the synergetic effects emergent from this interrelation came into view. These developments were energetically pushed forward by the three Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes under discussion. Under the influence of the research of Alfred Kühn at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Biology and of Adolf Butenandt at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Biochemistry, Eugen Fischer worked flat out on the restructuring of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology along the lines of the so-called phenogenetics. Today, we would say epigenetics. And he did so in a close cooperation and agreement with his designed successor, Fourier. Phenogenetics focused on the genesis of phenotypes. That means on the development of the organism according to the blueprint of the genome. In this process, the interdependences among different genes, the interplay between genetic trait and environmental influences, first and foremost, however, the influence of proteins, enzymes, and hormones, with whose assistance the hereditary information is inscribed in the body, and which are therefore located on the intermediary level between the genome and the phenotype, came under special investigation. Phenogenetical human hereditary theory was especially open to influences and impulses from the fields of experimental hereditary pathology, developmental physiology, embryology, and biochemistry. This new orientation of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology fitted neatly into the mainstream of genetical research in Germany, since the concept of transmission genetics, as developed by the American research group headed by Thomas Hunt Morgan, met with skepticism in Germany from a fairly early date. Against Morgan's idea to concentrate on investigating the mechanisms of passing down hereditary information via chromosomes, and on scrutinizing the morphological structure of these chromosomes, the criticism was formulated that this kind of genetics neglected the problem of the manifestation of hereditary characteristics, so that no light could be shed on the complicated development from the genotype to the phenotype. Different types of phenogenetics, which originated from this criticism, formed the mainstream of the genetic research in Germany during the interwar period, and they made up the specifically German quality of genetics in this time. It is the consequences of this shift of paradigms of human hereditary theory on the relationship between biosciences and biopolicy which are most interesting to examine. The scientific basis of the National Socialist hereditary and race politics was critically revised. Yet this process by no means resulted in bioscientists reducing their activities in this field. On the contrary, by a considerable intensification of research efforts, it was intended to refine and expand the available diagnostic instruments in order to be able to detect and destroy ill or foreign hereditary lines with more reliability and effectivity. As a matter of fact, in combination with the unlimited opportunities of access to human beings in asylums, ghettos, prisoners of war, and concentration camps, the high priority assigned to this field of research increased the velocity with which biopolicy descended into the abyss of crime. In the field of hereditary health politics, differential diagnostics were held to be the order of the day. In order to make the instruments of negative eugenics more effective, it had to be found out how to distinguish between diseases which came to existence prenatally and such diseases which were caused exogenously. Furthermore, one had to identify the several hereditary strands which could be concealed behind one and the same clinical phenomenon. And stigmata had to be identified which could be used as markers for pathological hereditary factors. All of the three Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes under discussion took part in such research on differential diagnostics in prominent positions. In fact, a certain pattern of labor division soon emerged. The Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Brain Research predominantly dealt with a wide range of mental disabilities and neurodegenerative diseases. The German Research Institute for Psychiatry focused on psychiatric disorders and also on mental disabilities, and the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology concentrated on physical disabilities, blindness, and deafness. In this process, the participating scientists also drifted into doing research accompanying the National Socialist Euthanasia Program. At the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Brain Research, for example, Julius Hallervorden and Hugo Spatz did their empirical work with the help of hundreds of brains which belong to euthanasia victims. And the very same is also true of Willibald Scholz, who worked at the German Research Institute for Psychiatry. At the same time, all three scientists closely cooperated with the two research departments which had been established at the Mental Hospital Brandenburg-Görden and the Psychiatric University Hospital of Heidelberg in the context of the euthanasia program. Ernst Rudin, director of the German Research Institute for Psychiatry, even delegated the psychiatrist Julius Deussen to Heidelberg, where he was to develop special psychological methods of examination which should be applied to the clinical observation of children who were gathered in the research department. After having been measured, these children were examined, observed, and subjected to a number of experiments. Finally, they were brought to the so-called specialized pediatric department of the mental hospital Eichberg near Wiesbaden, where they were murdered by an overdose of medical substances. Also, Hans Nachtsheim, who was the head of the Department for Experimental Hereditary Pathology at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology since 1941, profited from the research accompanying euthanasia. Together with a colleague, Gerhard Rohnstrut-Bauer of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Biochemistry, he used six epileptic children from the research department Brandenburg-Görden for a low-pressure experiment in order to find out about the influence of lack of oxygen in triggering of epileptic fits. The research of Karin Magnussen in the pigmentation of the human iris represented the keystone of research in the field of phenogenetics of normal characteristics at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology. She concentrated on heterochromia, the phenomenon that one person has a blue eye and a brown eye. For her study on heterochromia, she had herself sent the eyes of gypsies who had previously been put to death in Auschwitz. The contact to Auschwitz was initiated by Josef Mengele, who had worked at the Institute for Hereditary Biology and Racial Hygiene at the University of Frankfurt between 1937 and 1940, under Verschuer. After his promotion to Berlin, Mengele remained in close contact to Verschuer during 1943 and held the rank of a fellow at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology, whose director Verschuer had become in the meantime. At the end of May 1943, Mengele was promoted to Auschwitz, probably on his own initiative, but possibly with the consent of Verschuer. Magnussen's interest in the gypsy family with the heterochrome eyes brought immediate death to the objects of her research. For Mengele understood her request to let her have their preserved eyes in the case of their death as a summons for murder. There was at least one other link between Auschwitz and Dahlem. Mengele sent 200 blood samples of human beings from different racial backgrounds from Auschwitz to his mentor Verschuer to help him with his project-specific proteins. In contrast to former assumptions that this mysterious project aimed at investigations about the race-specific resistance or susceptibility to certain diseases, two colleagues of mine, Bernd Gausemeyer and Achim Trunk, have recently detected and persuasively explained that the development of a serological race test was behind this research project. This project, too, has to be assessed against the background of the shift of paradigms towards phenogenetics. After all, due to this approach, the race reports, which the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology produced for the genealogical department of the Reich, and which were largely based on the methods of classical anthropometry, turned out to be completely insufficient, since they only dealt with the outward appearance. Still, one assistant and three doctorands of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology traveled to Lodz in Poland for several times between 1939 and 1940 in order to carry out anthropological examination series with more than 250 Jews in the midst of executions, pogroms, and the desecration of synagogues, while at the same time tens of thousands of Jews were deported into the concentration camps or rounded up in the newly established ghetto of Warsaw. Also, two members of the Institute, Wolfgang Abel and Otto Bader, continued with the traditional anthropometric examination of soldiers from the French colonies in Africa and Asia and with members of the Soviet Red Army. However, in 1943, at the very latest, the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology entered the race for the development of an efficient race test beyond the boundaries of classical anthropometry. The genome was as yet beyond the grasp of the scientists. In his lecture in Breslau, Verschuer speculated on possible differences between the chromosomes of black and white people, but he was forced to admit that research was still groping in the dark in this respect. Thus, it was the level of the proteome on which research activities concentrated. This research was based on the speculation that each human race differed in the composition of its respective blood protein, a point which would have opened opportunities for finding a serological race test. Verschuer himself mentioned this possibility as early as 1930. Since 1940, when colonial soldiers became available in the prisoners of war camps, these research efforts were also intensified elsewhere. The immediate model for Verschuer's project, Specific Proteins, was another research project, which was also funded by the German Research Foundation and was headed by Karl Horneck, who was the assistant medical director of the Race Biological Institute at the University of Königsberg. Since 1941, Horneck worked with the blood of colored prisoners of war, with a declared aim to develop a solution to serological race diagnostics. Horneck's research was managed by Lothar Löffler, who held the chair of hereditary and racial biology in Vienna since 1942. At the same time, Löffler, as a former assistant of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology, belonged to the old Dahlem circle and was still in close contact to both Fischer and Verschuer. Via Löffler, Verschuer will probably have been aware of the progress of Horneck's project. In 1943, Verschuer started his own project, Specific Proteins, which largely followed Horneck's research design, but which used another method and which drew on another source of obtaining the necessary blood samples, namely on Josef Mengele in Auschwitz. Between 1939 and 1945, the three institutes transgressed all ethical limits of science. However, this process had already begun in the later years of the Weimar Republic, though by no means in a reflected or intentional manner, since from today's perspective, the participation in making a hereditary biological survey of the German people violated the basis rules of the legal protection of personality. By the way, this great project, Biological Survey of the German Population, was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. In this respect, the Third Reich represented a land of almost unlimited opportunity for the biosciences. The scientists received unimpeded access to sensitive data. Since 1938, at the very latest, they could examine any human beings in which they were interested without their consent and without paying the least attention to their human and civil rights. Human beings who were caught in the National Socialist camp cosmos were completely exposed to the power of science without any protection whatsoever. Ultimately, human beings who were set for extermination were taken advantage of as guinea pigs in criminal experiments, and their bodies were cannibalized for the needs and ends of pathological research. The ethical standards of science, which were formulated in the early 1930s, were especially violated and transgressed by scientists who entertained a somewhat reserved and skeptical attitude towards National Socialism. The delusion of anything goes, cherished by the scientific community at large, was not the result of political indoctrination or opportunism. On the contrary, the transgression of even the last boundaries drawn by law and convention, morals and ethics, had its source in the dual hubris of a form of bioscience, which on the one hand did not accept that its thirst for knowledge be fenced in by any means, be it through law, politics, culture, or religion, but on the other hand asserted its claim to reshape state and society, even the human condition, in a comprehensive sense, in the course of a rigorous biopolicy. The question here is not where this hubris comes from. It is one of the possibilities of the modern age. In this case, the destructive potential of man materialized behind the mask of reason. Sigmund Baumann masterfully elaborated the logic underlying this phenomenon by drawing an analogy to the gardener who weeds out the garden of humanity and wipes out vermin. There's no need to repeat this yet again. Rather, here the question is, why precisely this possibility of the modern age blazed the way? Why the many safeguards with which modern society constrains the traits of violence and destruction always inherent in modern science failed in this very special case? First, it must be stated that scientificity in and of itself offers no guarantees against transgressing ethical boundaries. It is a tenacious bias that science, or at least good science, in the sense of methodological appropriate science, must always be good in a moral sense as well, because the strict methodological standards of pure science prevent any research from drifting into barbarism. Inversely, this implies that morally reprehensible and ethically inadmissible research, from its very disposition, can be no science, but merely pseudoscience or, at best, bad science, in the sense of methodological inadequate. The history of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology demonstrates once more that this conception of an internal interconnection between methodology and ethics is more wish than reality. In terms of their methodological standards, the group of researchers around Eugen Fischer and Ottmar von Verschuer were doubtlessly at the pinnacle of their age. Even on the international scale, as the positive reception of the Verschuer speech read in absentia at the 7th International Congress for Genetics in Edinburgh proved in August 1939. Science is not invulnerable to drifting into the sphere of crime by mere virtue of the fact that it adheres to methodological standards. Inversely, morally reprehensible and ethically inadmissible research, including that which exposes humans to debasing procedures, scares them, or inflicts pain upon them, which willingly accepts the risk of a human subject's death or even brings it about, is not methodologically inadequate per se. painstaking scientific work alone, without ethical reflection on a meta level, generates at most scientific integrity, which may prevent fraud, fabricating and doctoring data, manipulating methods and suppressing, falsifying, or inventing results, but still cannot answer any of the ethical questions that concern the context of scientific praxis. Ultimately, it is decisive whether bioscientific research is constrained by the wreath of juridical, political, social, and cultural safeguards, or whether subject only to self-checks through a more or less reflected interior ethics. It simply follows its own logic. From the standpoint of an internal scientific ethic, nothing spoke against taking advantage of the freedoms hardly conceivable up to that time, which opened up for bioscientific research in the structure of the National Socialist State. On the contrary, because science is bound only to the guiding concept of the truth, as far as internal scientific ethics are concerned, it is practically imperative to exhaust the possible barriers to access human guinea pigs. Josef Mengele expressed this concisely when he was asked by a colleague why he took part in the selections at the RAMP of Auschwitz voluntarily. And Mengele answered, "It would have been a sin. It would have been a crime not to seize the chance Auschwitz offered to bioscientific research." With the same perfidious logic, it would have been practically morally reprehensible for Magnussen and Fourchet not to evaluate the eyes and blood samples supplied by Mengele, especially since pathologists had never been known for their scruples in procuring their material and bore no misgivings about researching on execution victims. Fourchet's case poses the questions of how this position could be reconciled with his Christian faith. Fourchet was a practicing Protestant and closely linked with the confessing church from its very beginnings, a circumstance that was suspect to the National Socialists. Since World War II, the apparent contradiction between Fourchet's support for the confessing church and his participation in National Socialist biopolicy had been pointed out repeatedly, whereby this contradiction was usually appraised as an indication that Fourchet got involved in the crimes of the National Socialist State against his inmost conviction in order to prevent the worst. This argumentation presupposes, as a matter of course, that the confessing church stood in fundamental opposition to the genetic health and race policy of the National Socialists. However, recent research on current church history suggests that large sectors of German Protestantism were by no means negatively disposed to the genetic health and race policy of the Nazis. And this was true not only for the German Christians, but also well into the ranks of the confessing church. Public criticism by the confessing church was oriented against the race ideology of Alfred Rosenberg and his adherents, who wanted to make racism into a substitute religion or a religious substitute, but not against scientifically grounded biopolicy. Large sectors of German Protestantism understood race, nation, and state as so-called preservation orders of God, such that the belief in God, the Creator, included the affirmation of race, nation, state as God's gifts. On this basis, Fourchet had no problem reconciling with each other bioscience, biopolicy, and Protestant Christianity. Starting in the 1920s, Fourchet developed his own rudimentary strategy of justification, which revolved around the concept of victim or sacrifice. I have to mention that the German language does not distinguish between victim and sacrifice. We have only one word for both of us, Opfer. And thus, the German language is particularly suitable for blurring the difference between these two levels of meaning. In his first speech, as a newly appointed member of the Prussian Academy of Sciences, in November the 10th, 1943, Verschuer had elaborated that even the people whose fate was restricted by their genetic disposition could give their lives value and meaning through selfless readiness to make sacrifices. On the one hand, this readiness to make sacrifices meant the willingness to volunteer for sterilization. But on the other hand, it also meant the willingness to place one's own body at the disposal of science, both with the objective of wiping out in the next generations that genetic disposition which had staked such close boundaries for their own lives. In Verschuer's eyes, the human beings who fell victim to the bioscientific research at his institute had made a sacrifice for science. And since in Verschuer's worldview, the researcher sacrificed his life for science, the unfettered research of human constituted a mutual act of sacrifice by the researcher and his research object. On this side, the heroic figure of the scientist, who in the service of science overcame his own fears and sense of guilt to advance into ethical boundary regions like the priest or executioner. He dehumanized him or herself to a degree. And on the other side, the people who are genetically inferior, whose existence receives value and meaning only through their being prepared as objects of science, that is also through dehumanization, albeit in the sense of objectification, bound in a ceremony characterized by concealed purification rituals and gestures of reconciliation. This attempt to give the events a sacred meaningfulness was a version of that connection observed since the early modern age between execution and torture, anatomy and experimental medicine, created from elements of the cult of the dead and the cult of sacrifice, which continues to be subliminally effective after the rationalist turn of science in the period, settling the outgoing 18th and incoming 19th centuries. This relationship of scientists like Verschuer and their human research objects is thus strangely ambivalent. On the one hand, it is governed by the methodological demand that scientific objectivity could only be guaranteed under the circumstances of the absolute suspension of feelings. This leads to a process of dehumanization, which makes material out of humans and subjugates those who exploit the material to moral anesthesia. On the other hand, however, this process of dehumanization is surmounted sacredly. It is the means to a higher end, and this end justifies the means. What follows from all of this? Bioscientific research is safe from drifting into barbarism only when it maintains respect for life. Finding the location of the Archimedes point upon which this respect for life is based may be a universal ethical principle derived from the world religions. Maybe Western humanism, an enlightenment aware of its own depth, a form of postmodern consensual ethics, that is the great challenge for bioethics in the coming decades. Only if we succeed in solidly anchoring the respect for life in the biosciences will they surmount the level of false learnedness, as Fyodor Dostoevsky once called it, and achieve true learnedness. The last words are to Dostoevsky. True learnedness is not antagonistic to life, but rather ultimately always accords with life, which it gives new revelations that it discovers in life itself. That is the essential and marvelous characteristic of true learnedness. False learnedness, on the other hand, is, no matter how great it may be, somehow always antagonistic to life, and, if anything, can lead to negation of life. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shmuel. I would like to entertain questions from the audience. First, I would just ask perhaps if you could elucidate a little bit in your discussion of the German Christians and the Confessing Church for those who may not be aware of the distinction.
Okay. In German church policy in 1933, there were two groups. And the one were the German Christians, closely linked with the National Socialists. And the opposition was the so-called Confessing Church. The opposition of the Confessing Church aimed at the intervention of the state into the organization of a Protestant church. This was not a fundamental opposition, as was told after the war.
The most famous person was Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was associated with that later, and Martin Niemöller. Okay. Questions from the audience or also from the persons listening on the webcast?
I'm interested in how Verschuer managed to retain his academic credentials despite his behavior during the war, whereas some other German scientists were tried as war criminals.
For some months, there was the danger for Verschuer to be the next one to come to the medical trial. and he was very afraid of this. There was never persecution. And after a few years, he got a professorship for genetics in Münster in Westphalia. And he was the man who dominated German genetics up to the 1960s.
To me, it is surprising that Verschuer and Fischer never thought of studying the obvious, let's say the difference between a dachshund and a German shepherd. I mean, they went to the most difficult topic imaginable, trying to find the difference between human races and doing serologic studies. I mean, the obvious, if you or I would have been in charge of funding research, you would have said, show me first that there's a difference serologically between a dachshund and a German shepherd or any other similar species. And there was no background for this. I mean, the concept of finding serologic differences between human races was founded on nothing, just a mere, pure, wrong hypothesis.
There was research on serological research on different species like dachshund and schäferhund at the Institute for Anthropology and elsewhere. And there was research on serological differences between races of animals, too. And there had been results, and this was the ground for the speculation that there could be differences in blood serum of different human races. It was a hypothesis at that time and was investigated at several places.
So we have a question from the internet. One of the people listening today on the web would like to ask you, it's a rather long question, I hope I summarize it accurately. The person writes, do you believe that the twin experiments performed by Fischer and von Verschuer were reflections of their own dual nature, that duality being the battle between a good scientist ego and some other? And do you agree that they wanted to punish one twin as a way of punishing their own unwanted selves? That's the question from the web today.
Oh, that's a very difficult question. I don't believe so. Twin research was just the most advanced method in human genetics in the late 1920s, and it was the gold standard of research, and I don't think that there were such psychological factors in the background. I'm not convinced of this thesis.
If I recall correctly, there were at least two examples in countries in Europe occupied by the Germans where the opposition of the church was effective in interfering with the policies of the Nazis in Bulgaria and in Denmark. Were there any attempts on the part of any of the churches in Germany or any of the organized religious groups in Germany as churches to oppose anything? And if not, has there been any recognition by these churches since then of their capitulation and participation?
The German Protestant Church only opposed against the church policy of the National Socialists because they refused the intervention of the state in the institutional organization of the Protestant Church. This was the only point they didn't agree with the regime. Another thing is, as I mentioned, Alfred Rosenberg. But Rosenberg was an outsider within the National Socialist movement. And in doing criticism on Rosenberg, the Confessing Church didn't opposite to the National Socialist regime at all. After the war, they were eager to build a legend that the Protestant Church was, from the very beginning, in opposition to the regime. But this isn't true. And only in the last years there had been research, especially on the attitude of the Protestant Church to racial policy. And there's a until to a large degree, the Protestant Church supported the policies of a National Socialist regime. I will give you an example. When Otmar von Verschuer was in Frankfurt as head of the University Institute for Racial Hygiene, he was befriended with a minister, a pastor named Otto Fricke. He was the head of the Confessing Church in Frankfurt. And after World War II, Fricke wrote a letter for Verschuer and said, I have visited his institute, and he has made marvelous signs. And this had nothing to do with race ideology of the Nazis. And this attitude is representative for the most of the German Protestants. It's another thing with the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church has not had not the tradition of state church in Germany. In the 19th century, there had been the Kulturkampf, a conflict between the Catholic Church and the state. And therefore, there was a greater distance between Catholic Church and the National Socialist State. But the Catholic Church was carefully not to attack the National Socialists too much because of the Concordat they had made in 1933.
At the high water mark was von Galen's opposition to the euthanasia program or for the Catholic Church?
On the Catholic side, there were some bishops. The most famous of them was August Cardinal Graf von Galen in Münster, who attacked the regime publicly because of the euthanasia program. But I want to emphasize that only single bishops did so, and not the German episcopate. That's very important. And von Galen, he was his political attitude was right-wing. And after his sermon at the pulpit in the church in Münster, the BBC reported that he was in opposition to the regime. And he openly and publicly declared, no, that isn't true. I'm not in opposition to our state. I only criticize the euthanasia measures, and I criticize the church policy of this regime.
Oh, yes, he asked if he would explain the Reichskonkordat.
The relationship between the Catholic Church and the state. is based on a so-called concordat. The Vatican tried since the 19th century to come to a concordat with the German government, and they couldn't achieve that, this because since the time of the Kulturkampf, the Prussian and the German state refused to make a treatise with the Vatican. And it was a sensation in 1933 that National Socialist government made immediately. The Concordat, the treaties between Germany and the Vatican, was passed by the government at the very same day, on the 14th of July, 1933, when they passed the sterilization.
Yes, I've had a question about the issue of the Protestant race, and maybe you're the person to ask this question. I've seen several references from the early 20th century to this. One was in a book for missionaries. It was in an English book, and they talked about how God had left the gold in the ground in California and South Africa and India until the Protestant race could find it. And then the other is the president of the California Institute of Technology. When he was trying to raise funds for the Morgan Lab at Caltech, he wrote to his the people he was trying to get money from in Pasadena that this genetic agenda of Morgan was important for the progress of the Protestant race. So there seems to have been some notion, and I've been wanting to follow that up, but maybe you have some insight that you can offer into that notion. What was meant by race? Was that just a careless use of terminology, or was there actually a widespread notion?
That's very difficult. There were several concepts of race in German research in the 1920s and also in the 1930s. And the most advanced was the concept of Walter Scheidt from the Hamburg University, who stated that races are not stable over a long period, but they are breeds who emerge very quickly in isolated places. And Scheidt himself made research on a little island near Hamburg, Finkenwerder, and he tried to prove that the population of this island had changed genetically within the last decades. And this very dynamic concept of race was adapted in the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology. Fischer did so. In his own research on the so-called Rehoboth bastards, he had an old-fashioned concept of race. But this was not up to date in the mid of the 1920s no more. And they changed to a more dynamic concept of race. And this was, I think, a big progress in research.
From your understanding of the deterioration of German practice and research in medicine, do you detect any danger signals in the present practice of medicine and medical research?
Today we have a discussion about research on people who are not able to give an informed consent to it. For example, children or old people suffering from Alzheimer's disease. And this is discussed in Germany very controversially. And I think there's a danger. This is a slippery slope. If we begin to do research on people who cannot give their informed consent, this is very dangerous. It is not allowed according to the Nuremberg Codex, which was formulated after punishment of the Nazi doctors in Nuremberg. And this is an achievement of humanity, I think, that we must struggle for. Another thing is the new debate about euthanasia, killing on demand, mercy killing we have in Europe. Perhaps you know that the euthanasia control, that the Netherlands had allowed euthanasia on a large scale. And every year in the Netherlands, around 1,000 persons are killed without willing in. And I think this is very dangerous, and we fight in Germany that our laws stay as they are.
Senior recruit felt that abortion began the slippery slope. How do you feel about that?
Fact is that in 1935, the abortion on eugenical reasons were allowed in National Socialist Germany, and about 30,000 women were subjected to such an abortion. According to the letter of law, this had to happen voluntarily, but it didn't. Many women were forced to abortion on eugenical reasons.
So we have another question from another one of our listeners on the web today, who notes, apparently Freud became a target of the Nazis in 1938. Any idea if he knew of the psychological experiments the Nazis were conducting, and if so, what his thoughts on them were?
Oh, I don't know exactly. Fact is that German psychology was involved in racial research too. It's very interesting. In the Institute for Anthropology, there was a department for genetic and racial psychology headed by Kurt Gottschalk. And they made twin research also in a great scale. And one of their aims was to investigate on differences between twins of different racial background. And also psychoanalysis was in part involved in the Nazi policies. I don't know how much Sigmund Freud knew about this when he emigrated from Germany, and I think he had no connections to this at all.
What became of Eugen Fischer?
Oh, he lived until the 1960s, and he published several articles, and he died as a happy man.
I'm wondering about your personal perspective on, a lot of us feel angst that genocide is still going on in our world, and in some ways we're highly sophisticated technologically, intellectually, etc. In other ways, it seems like there's some core barbaric component to man, and I was just wondering, you were explaining some of the different justification and thought processes of using some of this data for science. But I'm wondering, is there any kind of a genetic component or predisposition to mankind committing genocide? Or is it just looking at, you know, fear-based behavior, highly developed narcissism, being abused as a child, and so on?
I think there's a danger in genetics. But I think the danger comes not from the state today, but it comes from below, from people who say, so we have the opportunity to investigate prenatally if the child will be disabled, for example. And we want to use this chance, this opportunity. We have the right to do so. That's an example. Huntington chorea was a disease within the catalog of indications of the law for the prevention of diseased offspring. But there were, at that time, they had no method at their disposal for diagnostics, prenatally diagnostics. Nowadays we have. We can say the child will be disabled, will have this disease. So what to do? And some parents don't want to know. Others want to and say, we want this we want this to know, and we want to have the decision for abortion. And I think this is dangerous today. It's not the state demanding at the persons, at the individuals.
The elements of her question was she was wondering if there's a genetic disposition towards, say, genocide in human beings generally, or is it a cultural manifestation of influences? That's a in terms of the fact that human beings are on the one hand very highly sophisticated and very rational, and yet in situations can descend into great barbarity, both highly organized and sometimes less organized.
That's no guarantee not to drift off on a slippery slope that ends in a genocide, I think. Fashur and Fischer and the group around them were very sophisticated, I think. They were men of reason. And despite of this, or because of this, I don't know exactly, they got into the abyss of crime. And I think there is no safeguard in science itself, that's my thesis, that can avoid this drifting off.
Is there any kind of national remorse in Germany over the Nazis? All right. Do Germans feel bad about their history?
Yes, they do. Yes. There's a public conscience about the quality of this crime today. This has changed within the last two decades. When I began to do research on this topic, this crime was almost forgotten. This was a hidden crime. Only few people knew about this. And in the last two decades, very much research has been done in Germany and in other states and in the United States. And today, most people in Germany know what happened, and they feel guilty about this and ashamed. It's a shame. It's a unique crime in history to kill 300,000 helpless people. I think so.
Film next week on the Japanese context. Germany has done a much more thorough job in dealing and facing its past, particularly in this area of biological crime, than Japan, for example. And in part, one of the reasons was because after the war, the United States actually protected many of the researchers in Japan who did particular biological warfare-related research to protect the data so that it wouldn't come out. And it's a shocking chapter also in the U.S. post-war history.
For the twins' research, was there a particular age of the twin that they were looking for example, like babies or teenagers, or even interested in like middle-aged twins? Or
okay. First, I wanted to mention 10 years ago, I was invited to Japan, and we discussed how to handle with the past. And the Japanese colleagues say we want to learn from Germany how to handle this openly. And I think they on the way, but they have many difficulties in handling with crimes in Manchuria. Still on. To your question, to twin research, the researchers were interested in twins of every age, especially in children, but also in adults. The method was they scrutinized monozygotical and bizygotical twins in comparison. So that the differences of monozygotic twins are only caused by environment. The differences in the bizygotic twins are caused by environment and by the genome. And if we can measure the difference between the siblings of monozygotic or bizygotic twins, we can measure the influence, the impact of the genome. This was the German method. There was also twin research in the United States, but they had another method. They were looking for twins who grew up in different environmental circumstances. And then they investigated if they had developed different or in the same manner. These were two different methods of twin research.
Thank you very much. And again, this evening at 7 o'clock at the Science Museum, Professor Schmuel will be discussing euthanasia in National Socialist Germany. So thank you again, Professor Schmuel.